On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Livia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Ash Sarkar. Ash is a journalist, academic and political activist, known for her commentary on social justice, economic inequality and democratic socialism. Ash serves as a senior editor at Navarra Media. Her work has been featured in The Guardian and Independent, amongst many other places, and she's a familiar face on British television. Her debut book, Minority Rule, Adventures in the Culture War, examines how ruling elites exploit cultural divisions to maintain power. Ash, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you for reading my CV. It's my French GCSE going to go in there as well.
Very welcome to fit that now if you want.
Oui. Ash,
we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Probably my mum hiding the crisps from me, because I was addicted to the Safeway's ready salted, just like the shop brand crisps, and I couldn't get enough of them. And so there was a cupboard in the kitchen with a little gap between the top and the ceiling, and so she would hide them there because it was the spot that I couldn't reach. So that's probably my first food memory.
It sounds like you knew the hiding place, but you just couldn't.
Well, I could see it, and like that, you know, shade of red would be like taunting me from high above. That's when I first became a Marxist. I realized that redistribution was very important. But now my mum is a fucking great cook.
And what were mealtimes like in your family?
So they changed. So my mum, until I was 11, was a single parent. And so there was me, her and my sister, 6 years between me and my sister. And she was working, and she would often work till what felt like quite late when you're a kid. She was a social worker. So it's not as if there's an abused child, she could be like, oh, actually, I'm clocking off now. So that was a sort of, you know, she'd cook what she could, when she could. And she was just like, look, it's nutritional, like, you'll like it. But it was weekends with the family where like the real cooking happened. And so that would either be at my mum's house or my grandma's. My grandma had this little terrace house in Tottenham, and the, you know, those like little galley kitchens where one person can turn around, but not two. Mm. And just out of it would be like parathas, biryanis, bortas, dals, curries, and the never ending. And she had this like really unsafe gas cooker, like where I swear like we're all going to die of carbon monoxide poisoning. And I don't know how she did it.
And were you aware of being surrounded by good food at that point? Or did it just appear normal to you?
I think I was a bit jealous of my friends who had like the Dairy Lee Lunchables.
Yeah, I remember feeling that way as well.
Yeah, and that sort of like weird, sweaty, circular ham. And I was like, oh, I've got this like really beautiful chicken korma that my mum spent hours making. Oh, I'm so jealous. I want the Lunchable. It's only in hindsight you realise that that was a really special diet to be raised on.
So we always ask about school food. So were you taking food in, which is why you were aware of the kind of Lunchables versus the korma?
It depended. Sometimes had packed lunch, and my mum would do these like korma wraps, which were absolutely banging, and I still crave them. And I asked my mum the other day, like, would she make me a packed lunch? And she was just like, you are 32. Like, you don't need this. But sometimes there'd be school dinners, and this was pre-Jamie Oliver time. So I remember proper crack cocaine panda pops before they took out like all of the good stuff.
It's got a lot to answer for, Jamie Oliver.
I know, turkey Twizzlers. I loved the turkey Twizzler. Why was the meat that sweet?
I don't know what they were putting in it, but it did taste good.
It tasted great.
And university, what was your experience there, and what was the food like at that stage?
So I went to uni, and that's when you start having to cook for yourself. And there were all these experiments where I was trying to work out how do people feed themselves. And so I remember getting like just a sort of like plastic little box of random veg from Tesco's, which included a swede. And I was like, what do I do with this? and called my mum and I was like, what do you do with a swede? And she was like, throw it away. There's no reason to eat that vegetable. But that's also when I would start cooking for friends of mine who were from, shall we say, less seasoned backgrounds. And I remember asking a friend who I'd like recently made, like, oh, how are you with spice? And he was like, yeah, I'm great. And so I did the amount of chili that I would make for, you know, one of my siblings, and he cried.
Did you learn cooking at home with your mother or grandma? Or was it something, I mean, you talk about the Swede, but in terms of the stuff that you were eating at home as a child, did you pick that up whilst you were at home or sort of teach yourself retrospectively?
My grandma taught me how to make paratas, which are just still to this day one of my favourite things to eat. Flaky, buttery, starchy, oh, like, can't beat it. And she had this countertop, which was so 1970s, like it was made of tiles, so all the flour would get like stuck in between and she'd have to like scrub it out with a toothbrush afterwards, but they were so beautiful. I still think about her every time I eat a paratha. But for the high status family recipes, it's the biryani and it's the lamb curry, and my mum has taught me to make both of them. But what I've noticed that she does, and my grandmother did this as well, and my aunt does this, is if you go, can you give me this recipe for the thing you make? They will leave an ingredient out, so it never tastes quite as good.
It's deliberate.
So and you wake up quite... in the middle of the night, you'll be like, cardamom. It was cardamom.
And after you left university in the sort of early days of your career, where were you at that point? What were you cooking? What kind of food were you enjoying?
Right, leaving uni, I was working at a pub. I was working at a pub called the Blue Lion. So I ate so many plates of chips. And yeah, like sometimes twice a day you'd be eating pub food because that's what you'd get when you were on shift. So, you know, the like little snacky baby sausages that you get? Like, it was like living on those baby sausages. I mean, yeah, sounds delicious, but maybe a few years of that was a bit
not the healthiest.
And what about starting out in politics and journalism or political journalism? Were you living a healthy, happy life at that point, or were you surviving on, you know, kebabs and pints
of healthy
beer?
Happy people go into political journalism? I've not met one. I mean, to be honest, it wasn't a lot of eating kebabs. Although I love a kebab, I'm lucky enough to live not that far from Green Lanes in Haringey. So
good restaurants around there.
So good. And what's interesting about all these Turkish restaurants is that over the years they have become more upmarket and they've been done up. But it's not really gentrification because it hasn't changed ownership. So I think there's a food writer called Jonathan Nunn who says that it's the vajazzling, the yassification of of Green Lanes. Yeah.
I mean, Jonathan Nunn has done some kind of very interesting thing with the London food scene and has sort of, I think, challenged a lot of the previous food writing. What do you make of what he has done on that front?
It changed dating in London forever, because like you would go on like maybe like, you know, the second or third date with a guy. So this is like a young, left-leaning guy, millennial, that kind of age. And he would suggest a place and it would be like, okay, we've got to go to like a car park in northwest London just off of the North Cirque, and you go, this is a Jonathan Nunn recommendation.
I feel like restaurants should display that they are endorsed by Jonathan Nunn because it would sort of put it all together.
I told Jonathan there's a favorite spot of mine which I will never blow up my favorite spot, but I told him if I ever see you in there I will shoot you dead.
Ash, you came quite closely associated with the Labour Party when it was under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. Did you have many meals with Jeremy Corbyn, and how do you reflect on that time?
There was one meal that I can remember in an amazing curry house in Bolton. And so they had this upstairs room and this huge square table. And so there was Jeremy, there was a bunch of other people who were part of Momentum and the Labour Party. And it was the first time I'd seen him not mobbed by people and able to relax. I don't think he liked being in the limelight and being surrounded by press very much. He especially didn't like it. And he would, you know, be sitting there, he'd be eating his veggie curry because he's a vegetarian. And he would, you know, we talked about the sort of old like left-wing publishing of the 80s, and he was like, oh, I've got to give you this edition of Race and Class. You know, he was telling us about one of his brothers who I think passed away in a plane crash, which I'd never heard before. And it was a very different side of him. And I remember I was sitting there with my boyfriend at the time, now my husband, and he was waving his finger in my boyfriend's face, being like, the two of you have to get a flat and a cat. And we did.
Oh, that's good advice.
I was like, oh, if Jeremy says, we must.
Speaking of your former boyfriend, now husband, is it true you made your own wedding cake?
I didn't make my own wedding cake. That is fake news from the fake news media.
Ah, correct us then. What? Tell us about your wedding cake.
I made two wedding cakes for my friends. One for actually two friends of mine who got married to each other. And about a week before, she was like, babe, can you make me a wedding cake? And I was like, what do you mean? And then there was another wedding cake where we made it for a friend, where it was a joint effort between me and my best mate, Nadia. And we'd made the cakes themselves at my mum's house because she has the good oven with like the stable temperature. And then we had to take them up to, you know, a town near High Wycombe to store them in her mum's freezer. And on the way, one of my colleagues, Michael Walker, had this like raging house party. So we're like, should we go there? But then like hid the cakes under the bed to protect them. And then a couple of months later, took them out, iced them, and it was all good. So I've made two wedding cakes. But no, for my wedding, it was, we had lots of different friends make wedding cakes. So there was a gorgeous chocolatey one. I think there was some kind of lemony cake, and one that my mum was obsessed with, which was a coconut cake, and it was covered with sort of toasted coconut flakes all around the outside. So talented bunch.
Delicious. Just taking you back to the kind of food and political scene, if your book is about kind of culture wars, do you see kind of correlations between food and politics, and do you kind of enjoy discussions that go on relating to those two subjects?
We always use food as a proxy and to say something about people. And sometimes that's really playful. So the French calling the English, you know, roast beefs. Mm. And sometimes there's a connotation to it, which can be deeply wounding. So a friend of mine who's Turkish, on the playground, kids would call him kebab. And, you know, like curry would be a word flung at South Asians because it would mean dirty, kind of greasy, you know, to be looked down upon. And when it comes to this particular kind of, it's a way of making class into a kind of identity rather than an economic condition. What coffee do you have? Do you know what quinoa is? Have you ever seen an avocado in your life? And what's funny about that is that so many of the foods of working class people of color get turned into a code for bougie, because there's a thing of like, okay, well, it's a certain kind of middle class white person who accesses them.
No, it's very interesting. And I mean, when you look back on the London food scene, do you sort of reflect on it as having become more inclusive or less inclusive? I mean, obviously, there's a huge range of different cuisines on offer, but what's your sort of attitude to that?
I mean, the thing is I don't really know what the London food scene is, because I think there's a world of like reviews and restaurants that people want to go to and hype up. And then there's the places that I like to go where like I've gone since I was a kid. And like there's this one restaurant in particular, which is a Malaysian place, where my family have been going since my eldest cousin was a baby. And my mom, when she was pregnant with me, like her food cravings would take her there. So I've been having that sambal fish since I was an embryo. Mm. And so the idea of that being part of a food scene where, you know, the herd descends and then moves on, just these are community spaces. Mm.
Your new book, Minority Rule, looks at the idea of society being broken down into smaller and smaller hostile groups that are then pitted against one another. Do you think there is a positive role for food in bringing cultures together, or is that only a superficial thing?
Well, I think that connection is the best antidote to that kind of individualizing, atomizing, competitive tendency. And food is such an inherent part of connection. And when you think about some of the forms of radical organizing that have existed in the past, I mean, food's been a part of that. So there's the breakfast clubs put on by the Black Panthers in the United States. Or when you look at something like the Walter Rodney Bookshop, which was, as well as being a Black radical bookshop, a space for political organizing, people would bring food. And I think that, you know, there is a model of political activism, which is just weirdos sitting in a weird meeting for ages. And who wants to do that? Who wants to do that? There is nothing about that which brings you into closer community with people. But then there's another version where, yeah, you've got to have your meeting and you've got to slog it out with people, but there's food that someone has cooked themselves. It's such a generous thing when someone cooks for you, I think.
And do you consider yourself an ethical eater? Do you make... See, you haven't kind of dabbled with vegetarianism or anything like that.
I was vegan for about 5 minutes and then my mum made a chicken biryani. She made me a vegan version as well. And I was like, well, that's shit. I know it is wrong to eat animals. And yet here I am. You know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And the other flesh is delicious.
It's true.
Tell us about your own cooking now. I mean, it sounds like you are a pretty accomplished cook and baker. Is it something that brings you pleasure?
Oh, immense pleasure. It's my favourite thing to do. And, you know, I've been away a lot recently for the book tour, and the thing that I've missed the most is cooking. And not just cooking for myself, but cooking for my husband and our housemate, who's, you know, our shared best friend, and, like, you know, friends who live in the neighbourhood. Those shared meals are the thing which they keep me sane and they make me feel grounded and like I've got my feet on the floor. In terms of the principles of cooking, I'm quoting my mum a lot, which I think that must happen loads when people are talking about food. So yeah. They talk about their mum.
This is the whole premise of this podcast.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh my God. So my mum's got a saying where she's like, paste makes taste. Her theory is if you put any kind of paste into your cooking, it'll make it taste better.
What kind of paste? Like what sort of...
So, for her, a paste can be a ginger and garlic paste. It can be a spoonful of mustard. It can be some miso or some gochujang. But the principle, paste makes taste, is running in my head whenever I'm cooking. I'm like, what paste can I add to this?
And when you're not cooking at home, and let's hope Jonathan Nunn is not listening to this so you can answer honestly, but what restaurants do you like to go
Seems
to?
Seems unlikely.
if it's too fancy, I'm not going to like it. Like, I'm not going to enjoy myself. Like, you know when there are those restaurants where nobody laughs? I just, what's the fucking point? Like, you spend your hard-earned money to feel like you're being judged by everybody. Don't go to restaurants where there are too many skinny people because they don't care about the food. They don't fucking eat. And yeah, the places that I like to go, I'm not going to say where these places are. I'm just going to say what they are. There's an Afghan place which is amazing. And it's just like a load of like the local Uber drivers who go there, and the food is unreal. Like some of the best meat that I've ever had in my entire life.
What area of London? Or?
East,
okay.
It is generally east somewhere, and it's an Afghan place, and it's really, really good. Oh, I went to Rome on holiday at the beginning of this year, and I didn't have a single bad meal. And like, this is the thing which is going off piece from your question a bit, but like, I think is really important about the politics of food is that in the UK, we've made it so difficult to eat well, quickly and cheaply. And it's not because we don't have good ingredients. We've got incredible ingredients. We've got amazing dairy, amazing seafood, amazing meat. We bake so well. Our breads are gorgeous. But I think because we like maybe embraced industrialization that bit earlier, and then I think it became almost like a mark of status to have these like American style processed foods. I mean, my stepdad talks about how, you know, when his mum got like something out of a tin, that was the posh thing. And it means that we've lost our connection to loads of those ingredients. Whereas in Italy, you know, it's like you're walking around and it's just like, bam, salami, like, oh, incredible pizza, like best gnocchi that you're going to have in your whole life. And it's everywhere. And it makes me sad we don't have that. It makes me feel like we don't value pleasure very much.
Do you have a sweet tooth?
Not really. I'm a savory girl. I've got a friend who he's very impressive in all sorts of ways, very, very clever man and all the rest of it, but the most impressive thing I've ever seen him do is eat 5 ice creams in one day.
That's quite impressive.
It was insane.
Why did he do that?
Well, like, we were on holiday together, so we were just wandering around. And like any time we saw like, you know, a gelato place, he'd be like, 1 minute. And then it was like, you know, we got to like the end of the day. We're about to go back to the place we were staying. It was maybe like 11 o'clock at night. And there was like one gelateria left open. And he was like, we meet again.
That's very impressive. And what about a drink, Ash? Do you like a drink?
Yeah. Who have you been talking to? My favourite cocktail is an old fashioned mid-century Don Draper chic. Oh, love it. This is going to make me sound terrible. I'll pretty much drink anything apart from red wine because it turns me into a psychopath.
And what is comfort food for you?
I've got a really specific memory of comfort food. So my stepdad, he passed away last year, and when he died, I was thinking about this a lot. You know, he's a typical Yorkshireman. So he didn't like speaking with words and couldn't, you know, heave his heart into his mouth. He was all about actions and just doing something practical to let you know that he was there. And so when I was a teenager, my mom and my sister had gone on holiday. And so it was just me and him in the house. And I got dumped. I got dumped by, you know, fucking idiot. But like, I got dumped. And so my stepdad didn't really know what to do with this like crying teenage girl. And he would be like, oh, are you still upset about so-and-so? And then I'd hear his name and like burst into tears all over again. And I think he was racking his brain for like what could make her feel better. And he remembered that when I had braces, he would have to make me this like very buttery mashed potato because that was the only thing I could eat because my teeth hurt. So then he thought the same would apply because I had my heart broken. And so anytime I started crying, like a new bowl of mashed potato would like appear in front of me.
That's very sweet. As we normally finish with a question about your desert island meal, kind of last mm-hmm. dinner, I'm going to slightly tweak it for you to also ask who would you want to have at that meal, perhaps from a kind of political point of view. Like who would, if you're putting together your final dinner party and you could choose the food.
I nobody from politics at my really? Final dinner party. No, because I want to fucking enjoy it. Why would I have any of these socially maladapted people there? I would want my husband, our housemate, my best friend Nadia, my mom, my friend Layla. Like the idea that I would be like, okay, well, like the people I would really want, it would have to be Stuart Hall and it would have to be, I don't know, like Bernie Sanders. Like what kind of sad motherfucker would say
quick,
that? Like
check don't you get
oh my god.
Well fair enough, okay, completely understood. But what would you serve to these people?
Okay,
what
well,
you have as your meal?
All right. So it's for my mates. It's for people
it's
I
for
like.
Mates, yeah, we've all established
right,
that.
All right, so it's for people I like, thank God. Okay, to start, razor clams. Because they're hard to get, and but when they're good, they're so good, and you don't need much. You just need some lemon and some olive oil and some salt and some cracked black pepper. That's it. Razor clams, maybe carver, a nice carver for the main...
Champagne socialism.
Oh, yeah. Carver communism, actually.
Carver communism.
For the main, a friend of mine gave me this recipe, and it's unreal. So what you do is you take a sweetheart cabbage and you quarter it. You sear it off. Meanwhile, you like brown a load of butter. You put some gochujang, some miso, some honey and some garlic through that. Then you coat the cabbage in your brown butter sauce and you put it in the oven for a while. I don't know how, but it just becomes this almost like meaty, like, but falling apart, like delicious thing. So I think that would be the main. And then maybe the dessert would be tiramisu for my pudding fiend friend.
And to drink, not red wine. Or have you got, no. We've got the carver. We've got the carver.
Yeah.
Would you keep the carver or do you have something else as well?
How big's my budget?
It's unlimited.
Unlimited. Oh, I'm going to die, so I don't have to pay off the debt, so it's fine. Ooh, don't know. I really like Vino Verde. Mm. I love a Vino Verde. And there's a shop near me that, you know the one that everyone's drinking at the moment? Chin Chin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, at the restaurants, it's like 36 quid or something. I found a place that'll do you bottles of it for £11 near me.
Gonna ask you where that is once we stop recording.
I will never blow up my spot.
Well, Ash, thank you very much for joining us on Table Talk. And Ash's new book, Minority Rule: Adventures in the Culture War, is out now.
Thank you.